we are Mitch and Kathy Finley, and the title of this session is Family, the Holy and the Ordinary. 55 minutes, time limit. Okay, what we'd like to do to begin, how many were here, not here yesterday, or the day before? A few people. Okay, I want to recap a little bit where we've been and before we move on to where we're going. We started out with the basic notion, trying to make a case for the idea that family, or whatever one's basic web of relationships may be, constitutes the most basic unit of the Christian community or church. That family constitutes an ecclesial reality. Family is an authentic community of the baptized. Okay? So that therefore, our attention, if we want to look at the basic cell of the church, needs to focus on families of various kinds and nourishing those families if the bigger body of the church is going to be healthy. I'm a little reluctant even to use the word family, but I think we probably need to do that. Because what we're essentially talking about is we're saying that Christian spirituality, the Christian life as a whole, is a relational reality. It's relational. It is not me and Jesus off in a corner by ourselves. Okay? It is precisely in my relationships with those with whom I live most closely that I live out my Christian life. I don't do it in private or kind of in a way that is unrelated to the real world. Okay? That's why we titled our book Christian Families in the Real World. Because so often when people start talking about Christian family life, they end up with a lot of very unreal sort of spacey things that have nothing to do with the realities that that any family has to deal with. So that's what we're trying to get at. Then yesterday we focused on the idea. Now, these, we said, are the implications of this idea. And we don't have time to deal with all these in a whole lot of depth this week. But we focused yesterday on this idea that one of the implications of that is that therefore a Christian family or a network of basic relationships, whatever that may be, is called by the gospel to live a countercultural lifestyle and a countercultural spirituality. I came across a quotation recently by Flannery O'Connor that is very apt. She said, you shall know the truth, and this truth shall make you odd. You know, and I think that's a good way to put it, with a little humor in there. You know, if we aren't a little bit odd and perceived by people who, you know, are not attempting to live a gospel kind of life as a little bit odd, then maybe we're missing the boat as far as actually trying to do this for real. You know, it may be just little mental games we play with ourselves. A lot of people in our society use religion as a sort of spiritual aspirin, you know, something to make the pain go away. If anything, I think an adult encounter with the gospel is liable to make us just as uncomfortable as it is liable to comfort us. You know, the old business of the gospel is supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. If we don't feel afflicted by the gospel about as often as we feel comforted by the gospel, then maybe we're not really looking at the gospel right in the eye. Garrison Keillor said, I believe that sometimes you just have to look reality in the eye and deny it. You know, it's that kind of thing. That reality that everybody else takes so seriously, maybe we are called to not take quite so seriously.
Who uses the term cognitive deviance?
Oh, yeah. There's a sociologist of religion, a Lutheran, as a matter of fact, by the name of Peter L. Berger, who once, 20-some years ago, wrote a book called A Rumor of Angels. And he defined Christians as, he said, anybody who takes the gospel seriously, in sociological terms, could be described as a cognitive deviant. Okay? Because we're deviating in terms of the ways we think. And one of the most important implications of that is that we need other cognitive deviants, you know, to associate with in order to reinforce our deviancies, you know? So if we're not being cognitive deviants, then we're missing the boat. All right. So, now then, and the primary principle we said yesterday that underlies this countercultural thrust to our lives is one based on relationships. Okay, placing relationships with God and other people as the ultimate standard in our lives is what places us in a countercultural stance in the world and in our society. Once we say that is our ultimate standard, then we can't help but be, in Flannery O'Connor's terms, odd and different, and perceived as such. Okay, if we don't look different, then maybe something's out of balance there. All right. So, the Christian life is a relational life, and this is kind of where that comes in. And the reason that is so, the reason that we can, one of the characteristics of that is going to be that. Or one of the reasons we say this is because, let's see, I'm not being clear here. I'm thinking of about six things at the same time, and I've got to pick one of them to say. One of the characteristics of an authentic Christian community, including a Christian family, is that it is there that we are going to have our deepest experiences of joy and anguish. Somebody once described parenting as rage, 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 and joy. And they tend to happen at the same time. I mean, it's any parent I think would vouch for the fact that that is a very good kind of summing up of our experience. You know, and just when you think rage is kind of the bottom line, all of a sudden you have one of the deepest experiences of joy that you could ever expect to have.
And we'll be talking more about parenting
tomorrow. Right, too. We're going to get into parenting later. Okay, today we want to move on to this area here. And at that point, I will... Do you want me to say anything else before I...
No, I guess not.
Nothing else I should say, right? Okay.
I think that's a place to jump here. As I've mentioned before, those of you who've been here before, Mitch and I come out of a Catholic tradition, and so there'll be some differences that may show up a bit more here in our topic today than in some of the others. But I think, how many of you were not raised in a Christian or religious atmosphere at all? There was no religious emphasis in your background. Okay. Most of us then had some grounding in Christian or religious values. And what I'd like to ask you to brainstorm with me about right now is, what elements were there in your growing up years that gave you a sense of your faith reality, your faith identity? What were things that helped you to know your identity as a Christian, as a Lutheran, whatever you grew up as, that were there as reminders of this is who you are and what is a part of your life? Is the question clear? Okay, what would be some of those experiences that you would recall?
Going to church.
Okay, going to church.
Where is it now, Ken?
Okay. Can I just go back to going to church for a sec? Was there anything specific about that? Like, oh, was that dressing up?
Yeah.
Sunday clothes, okay. Anything else? Was there anything else special about the time of going to church, about the day of Sunday?
That was assumed that we did go on Sunday.
Okay, there was no question about everybody went, okay. Okay, I just wanted to kind of be as specific as possible. And someone mentioned prayer at mealtime. How did that happen? Tell us a little bit about what that was. Was it... a specific prayer? Was it led by different people? Who did you suggest one?
It was done in a variety of ways.
Okay.
We sang sometimes, we sang together as a family, mm-hmm. or one person had a prayer.
Okay. So there was a variety of the format. Okay.
My mother, just the way she lived.
Okay. So your mother was a model, huh?
She did everything at church that you could possibly do.
Okay, so one thing was her church activity. What about at home?
She was at home too, but mm-hmm. I think I guess I saw more of it at church than in our home.
Okay. So she was one of those great women of the local church that you could rely on her no matter what the need was. Okay. Other people have that experience, perhaps? Yes?
About an extended family in the congregation.
Okay. Can you say more about that?
We had many, many picnics.
Uh-huh.
Got to know virtually the entire congregation as very, very close friends.
Uh-huh.
Look back on that time now as a very close-knit and nurturing time.
So you had a sense then as a child growing up that you had some other important and reliable adults in your life besides just these two people, and that if you needed something, you could probably about as easily go to one of them.
I don't know about the last part.
Yeah, that's pushing it a bit. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Dan?
And a whole flurry of things like no meat on Friday,
okay.
Going to confession, saying the rosary.
This list goes on and on and on for Catholic. And you know what, too? We found, now we've done this a bit in the Midwest and the East Coast, the further east you get, the longer the list becomes. Okay, no meat on Friday.
No meat on Fridays.
Anybody else besides Dan and Mitch and I have a Catholic upbringing? Did you? Yeah, okay. No?
Italian Lutheran, that's close to coming.
We always got blamed for the fact in school you had to have fish sticks on Friday.
Oh, yeah. Anything else you want to add?
Well, it's saying the rosary and going to confession and the Mass in Latin. I mean, they were all kind of exterior things, but they really gave me a sense of the mysterium tremendum kind of thing of God.
Oh, yeah. I have to tell you something about this one. The other day, I forget for what reason, our youngest is almost 9, and we were talking about the old church, you know, the church before Vatican II, and we said, but Kevin, you don't have any idea what that was like. I mean, you know, obviously none of them were born. And he said, oh, yeah, he said, you said it in Latin, and you he didn't say face the wall. He said, you said it to the wall. That was
got the basic idea here.
Okay. So rosary, confession, my memories of the rosary were we would say it at Lent, and you had to kneel, and you had to close your eyes. And I would always get dizzy. That's all I remember.
I think I have, too. I think Bible stories at bedtime or whenever.
Uh-huh.
And I think maybe a tolerance or a, I don't know if tolerance is the right word, but you're kind of brought up that you respect those other people.
Other religious traditions?
Out of religious, your neighbors, or they're not, like maybe the media can say they're all bad or something, but then on the other side, you have to remember they are, or I guess it's tolerance.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's...
They're God's creatures too, and mm-hmm. God's children, and so we need to respect them.
And okay. Try to see their point of view, mm-hmm. not just...
Okay.
At holiday times, our family would emphasize, like at Christmas time, we'd have Santa Claus in the morning, but before we opened our gifts on Christmas Eve, we would have the Bible story, which my father always read, and at Easter it would be an emphasis, you know, away from... I felt like there was more of a religious emphasis.
Uh-huh, okay. And it sounded like there was pretty much of a ritual that accompanied that really evolved in your family. Yes?
Vocational expectations. It was just sort of assumed that you would go into some kind of helping profession.
Okay. And that probably, I don't know, may have taken some rather subtle forms in terms of being praising and being impressed with people who had done those things, and that was the way it was in our family or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Parochial education.
Okay. And now there, we've hit, there's a lot there, huh? Uniforms, right?
Yes.
And real nuns. Real nuns in habits. I usually get a chuckle out of a group when they're, you know, more contemporary dressed nuns and so on these days. Also part of parochial, I only went to parochial school for a year or two, but there was also Mass in the morning, and then you could bring your breakfast and eat it in the classroom before most of you missed out on theology. But, how about for Catholics, two holy cards and novenas? Now, Sunday school, would that be an important part of your experience of...
For youth groups.
Okay. Tell me, is there something specific about Sunday school that you recall, or church camp experiences? How about...
Especially the Christmas and Easter programs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Programs, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Add something else there?
The church camp, I remember.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Learned how to kiss girls at the church camp.
Mine's sort of like it, not quite as clumsy. But I had a neighbor family that took me to church. That was how I got to church. And I continually, and I have talked to them about how I value them doing that. And my parents were open to having me do that, but they just didn't work themselves, not happy. But what I remember when I think of Sundays all the way through, I remember all my friends that went to church, that all the way through my time, all the way through when I was in elementary school and high school, those friends went to church. And it was like, we went to school together, but we also went to church together. And I can think of us, at some point, the boys sat on one side, this was about sixth grade, and the girls sat on the other side at the Sunday school table, and the boys shot spit wads at us, of the girls, without the Sunday school teacher seeing us,
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I remember it. It was significant. It kept me going,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
I had that group of friends.
Sure. So there was, at some point, a peer support, and it sounds like, in many of the tight-knit local churches, you began to have not just the support and or pressure from your parents, but also the support of peers in terms of, these are some friends, at least, that I have in a church context.
I think it's even without the church, outside of your own church. I was just mentioning to my wife that we had being a congregation was raised, we had a Catholic family living on one side and a Jewish family living on the other. and we all played together. I went to his bar mitzvah,
uh-huh.
and had gone to the Catholic church too,
uh-huh.
but we all
uh-huh.
had our own churches. So
wow.
we respected everybody's religion.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know about others' impressions, but my first impression is, when we were growing up, that was pretty unusual, because we were told as Catholics we couldn't set foot in anybody. I remember the first time going to a Protestant wedding, thinking, am I doing anything wrong here? Am I really supposed to be here? Does the Pope know about this? I mean, it was crazy stuff, but that was yeah. pretty much the way it was. A lot of intolerance in a lot of places, I think. Anything else before we move on here?
Potluck suppers.
Okay.
Casseroles.
My favorites.
With mushroom soup as a base, right?
Norwegian things you didn't recognize.
Yeah.
I'm not Norwegian.
What about, were there any, Bible-type revival kinds of experiences or anything? That seems like when I was talking to an Episcopal group, that was a big thing. It was like that, yeah.
I like
that. Because for Catholics, we had missions, where you'd go and they'd preach at you interminably and you'd get bored and parents would tell you to be quiet and sit there. And my first experiences of church were, you weren't big enough to see over the pew, and so you just had to kind of, figure something was going on there, because, in the Catholic churches, you didn't leave for Sunday school at that point, you had to stay. Okay.
Vacation Bible school.
Okay. What we see here, it seems to me, and again, it'll vary somewhat from one denomination or one tradition to another, is a pretty rich network of an environment in which faith can be fostered. In a sense, it's a pretty multimedia environment. Again, our experience as Catholics, there were liturgical colors. I don't know how strong those are in your tradition. We used incense. That's not used as much anymore. But there were all these sight, sound, smell sorts of things that were a part of this. And I think it's pretty rich in the Lutheran tradition as well. How many of the things that you see here would not be the case for your own children or children that you know today? See, again, I'm not quite sure whether the contrast is striking. When I talk with, when we talk with Catholic groups, a number of the kinds of things, we didn't get into novenas and, you know, a number of the kinds of traditions that have really, as a style of expressing one's faith, have really gone out of common practice. Some of these things may have done that to some extent. It seems like a lot of them wouldn't have. But I think there's a challenge for us as parents today to look at how we provide an environment that gives frequent reminders of the reality of the identity that we have in faith as Christians. Because it seems to me, in my experience, and I think this is pretty common, it's easy for me to forget the depth of God's love, the way I want to try to live my life, and I need reminders. I need ways in which that will happen. It seems to me as well that, again, this may be more Catholic than Protestant, a number of the kinds of things that, as a Catholic, I could name, and some of these things that I see up here as well, are elements that were more church-centered, church in the sense of a place, a building, an institution, rather than things that happened at home. And the shift that I see as well is, for example, one of the things that, I mean, was hot stuff when I was growing up was at one point in CCD class, because I was in Catholic school most of the time, I was given as some kind of a prize, I'm sure, a holy water fountain. This is a kind of a Catholic thing, but anyway, it was a glow-in-the-dark holy water fountain. This is right inside my bedroom door. That was hot stuff, you know. Well, what it was really, as I think about it now, was a little bit of church brought home. And the sense was almost to make holy, to bring from the holy place to the not-so-holy place, something that would remind me about my faith. And I want to suggest, and I guess argue today, that what we want to do is not so much bring the holy into the home as look again at what's already in the home as being holy, that we don't need to bring the holy into it or make things holy. It's already incredibly holy, but it looks so ordinary and it's filled with so much hassle most of the time that it's easy to forget that it's holy. If we talk about your house for a minute, what would be the single most holy place in your home?
Kitchen.
Anybody else?
In what sense do you mean holy? And I associate in some ways the living room was holy because we weren't allowed to go in there.
Well, I wouldn't quite mean it in that sense, I guess.
They kind of go together, living room and kitchen, because they're both places for
people
to
play. Some people have a problem switching gears to talking about holy at my house. beyond that, most people would mention the dining room or kitchen table as a place where we gather. Although often another suggestion that's mentioned is the parents' bed as a place that's a holy place for the marriage. And I think that's true, but I think there's something really special about the family table. If I had first asked you to picture your family of origin, and asked you where you pictured them, probably you would picture them around the family table because that's where we really most often are, you know, all geographically together. It's also intriguing, though we won't go into that, to talk about where did various people sit and therefore what were the lines of communication that were happening and not happening and so on. But so if that family table is a naturally holy place in the home, then what do we do about, you know, the process that I'm suggesting of not talking about making holy or bringing in the holy to the home, but enhancing the holiness that's already there? Well, it seems to me that then if we gather, you know, around the table for a family meal, and we got into this a little bit last night, which is a tricky thing at best. I think most of us would experience to some degree or other the family meal as being pretty much of an endangered species. How often at your house does everybody gather for a meal? Just to give us an idea. Anybody want to?
Six nights a week.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very seldom in my house because my kids don't all live at home. Uh-huh. None of them are married, but they work. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm alone.
So holidays and maybe a few other
Sundays.
Times. Sundays, okay. Mm-hmm.
7 days a week, but many of them in front of the television.
And we talked about that last night, about half the homes in the U.S. have TV on at dinner.
My household for the last at least 10 years has not been family of origin. It's mm-hmm. been with other adults. And,
right.
And some of that very intentional, some not. But even in the most intentional one, we gathered one evening a week, two breakfasts a week, you know, and hopefully a brunch on Sunday.
Yeah.
That was a lot, trying all three of us to coordinate our schedules.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think ours is pretty much 7 nights a week, but it's tricky when the game schedules start and that sort of thing. Invariably, some of those tend to happen through the dinner hour. So, oh, and when I was going to class this last year, it would be really squeaking it if I would get home before they were through eating or have to leave before they all fed, you know, one of those. It's kind of crazy.
Before we move on from that, I'd like to suggest that a really good thing to think about with regard to a family meal is what takes priority. You know, in our culture, we tend to just, as parents, have this, I don't know, mindset, predisposition that says, well, if it comes down to a conflict between basketball practice for the kids and the family meal, obviously basketball practice takes priority. We don't say this, but our behavior acts out that presupposition. And I would like to just suggest that maybe it ain't necessarily so. You know, maybe there's some room for compromise and bending on both parts there. Maybe we ought to have a little chat with the coach.
Right.
And say, look, you know, our family table time is important. And matter of fact, coach, it's more important than basketball. I know that's a hard thing for you to, you know, understand.
You tell
maybe,
your child not to play.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so much schedule.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
you know, saying something like that here is easy, but
yeah.
when you get there,
yeah.
your
I
kid
know.
Has tears coming down his eyes and saying, "I want to go to
mm-hmm.
basketball."
Mm-hmm.
The coach said, "If I don't play, mm-hmm. he's got five other kids that he's going to play." And
that's
I'm,
right.
you
know,
I know.
It's not easy. Ours are right in the middle of that.
Yeah.
One of the things too that we've said, and again, we're not saying this is all you know going to work in your situation and it's all easy. We've told our kids, basically, outside of school hours, you have one main outside activity. You cannot do music lessons and athletics and this and that and that. They're all good things, and we hope you have a chance to do them all at some point, but we aren't running you three different places, you know, in the course of a week, you know, if you've got practice three times a week for this and two times a week for that, whatever. You just have to choose one or the other, and that's not easy, and it's not popular.
Does that rule apply to you and your husband also?
It's an interesting thought.
What rule is this now?
About one outside activity.
I think
pretty much does.
Actually, I don't know if I have any outside
activity. Sometimes I've had more than the kids.
That's a good thought.
Well, that's
yeah.
easier to say. You said, you know, your kids' age, and my children are about that age too, but they're going into that middle school. We're in a middle school situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And things begin to change a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And especially the child has like church youth group, are you going to say, therefore, you can't belong to a basketball team?
Mm-hmm.
That's two things right there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I think every family has to work this out in terms of their own particular circumstances. But I'm simply raising the question, you know, of where ultimately, you know, are our loyalties? What is the ultimate priorities here? And instead of just assuming that if there is an outside demand, obviously that outside demand, you know, has precedence, to at least be willing to say, okay, we're willing to compromise. We'll move a dinner time back a little bit. But maybe the basketball practice should move itself a little bit too, you know, so we can all give a little bit here and benefit. And it's not always, you know, there are times when you can't do that. But I guess I would just like to say that I think we need to be a little more uncomfortable about it, maybe, as a culture, than we already are. And bring it up at parent, you know, PTA meetings and things like this and say, hey, if this isn't good for the family, is it really good?
Your assumption is that the holiest place in the family is the dinner table. Can we assume that there are other places, like bedtime?
Oh, I think so. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think so, definitely, yeah. And can I get to that in just a minute? Is that okay? I'd like to go back to the question of the table, and what are some thoughts that you might have as far as how we could enhance what happens whenever we do manage to make it around the table?
I think it's not only the society or the school. I think not each father or mother likes to cook that much either.
Mm-hmm.
Because I must say every day, cooking up a meal gets a little unclean. You know, I think everybody should pitch in too, and mm-hmm. it should. And if you have a nice meal together, it's nice to have a nice meal and not just whatever.
Yeah.
Fish and chips.
Yeah.
Fast food. So I think it's kind of a, you can't really put your finger and blame it on the school activities or blame it on this or that.
Yeah.
You have to.
Yeah.
Work it out together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You do have to make choices. One of the ones that we made was not to get a microwave when we built our home.
Mm-hmm.
And so any meal that's prepared, it's prepared the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the smells and the sights and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that you can recall back when you were a child, all those aromas wafting
through.
I
think it should be something shared and not stuck on the mom.
Well, again, that's a value at your house that may not be a value at others' houses.
But I can see why I see other American moms, and they don't always have time.
Sure.
They don't have dinner.
More times than not anymore, they've just come home from work, and why should it always be me that has to rustle something up real fast, you know?
And or it's easier just to kind of
We have some good friends that I remember, the kids were older than ours, or we didn't have kids at that point. What they started doing was they signed up each week for, each family member signed up this each week for which meal they were going to do. And we're talking basically about the evening meal, because we're going to school, and so they ate lunch at school, and breakfast sort of cereal. And that was, you know, turned out several things. Talk about being a real communion of the food, and that the kids share what they made, what they were excited about making something they really wanted to, and they learned about cooking. And it got the adults off the hook. And there was, you know, it's when they're ready, it's not when they're 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My kids do that, and it really doesn't get the adult off the
hook. Yeah, I was just going to say.
Let me tell you, my kids wrestle up 4 hours for the dinner, and the TV 30 minutes, but it's good. I mean, it's something they enjoy doing, and it's a learning process, and all that's right, but it really doesn't get the mother off the hook, let me tell you.
Yeah.
But it gets back to what Mitch was saying earlier, it's all about what priorities do you establish?
What values, that's right. Let's come back to the family meal thing, because I really want to get to a number of other topics, but I think this is a really important one. That brings up for me one of the occasions in the year that I think is really key. Yes, there are important holidays that we need to take into account. We can talk a bit more about that in a minute. But it seems to me one of the most naturally holy occasions in the year are birthdays. Because there's a sense in which, you know, we have this unique time in the year to celebrate you as gift, you know? And I think no matter how old we are, there's a part of us that doesn't really want people to know it's our birthday, but there's another part of us that, you know, really wants, by the way, tomorrow's my birthday, you know, that sort of thing. And so if we can really work on enhancing that time of saying, thank God for you, without you, none of us would be who we are. You know, you're a real special gift. Sometimes you're a pain in the rear, but you're really a special gift to us, you know. And this is the time to celebrate that. And I don't know how you do this at your house, and I'd really like to hear some ideas. And so, One way, if you're really organized, which I rarely am, is to kind of pull out some of the baby pictures and that sort of thing a few days before so we can sort of anticipate the feast, you know, and really kind of savor. It's really special to see how you've grown and who you are and where you come from. And also, you know, we have, has anybody ever seen the red plate? It's the ceramic plate. You get the red plate at our house on your birthday, and we do a pretty good job, a little bit more so when I was growing up, if you get to choose what you're going to have for dinner that night, and, you know, a few of those sorts of things. But, you know, isn't it okay to do a second verse of Happy Birthday that says, May the good Lord bless you, or whatever, you know, to really have a special prayer that says, you know, we really appreciate who you are. And maybe, you know, if all goes well, we can go around the table and talk about one way in which we appreciate the gift of who you are. What are some other ways that you do this?
The birthday you're talking about specifically? We have the red plate too.
Uh-huh.
And when we get up early enough, we have breakfast in bed for the person's birthday.
Uh-huh.
It's mostly for the parents because the kids are always up earlier though.
Yeah. It's pretty nice.
We have the candle.
Uh-huh.
And then the child can kind of choose what they want to do that day.
Ah, okay.
And, but I think those suggestions about pictures,
mm-hmm.
it's a good idea because they love to talk about when they were young.
Mitch has taken a lot of slides, and we haven't really gotten a projector unless we borrow one for him, but my ideal would be to have carousel for each kid, and, you know, and add slides as we go of this is who you are and how you've grown and some of the crazy things that we've recorded along the way. Yes.
When our kids got big enough to want their friends at birthday instead of the family members, and they wanted superhero napkins instead of the things that we had done before, we tried to celebrate their baptismal day as an alternative. It was so easy for this holy to get lost, mm-hmm. but that's an easy one to forget too.
Yeah, yeah.
More than two kids, I never remember.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That's one alternative that has helped us some years to have an extra holy time for that child. Or we would celebrate the same way as you might on a birthday, but with a smaller celebration, something that happened at school
mm-hmm.
or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a judgment thing. This child needs this special time, or this child needs to see that one have a special time,
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what are some of the naturally holy things that are happening in our homes and the transition times as things change and grow in our families? What are some of those other ones besides birthdays? We might not necessarily name as holy until we look closely.
Maybe family reunions.
Okay, those would be clearly that.
Confirmation.
Pardon?
What are you talking about, confirmation?
Confirmation, yes. But I'm really talking about not so much church-related in church in the sense of over there. Graduation, okay.
Yes, report cards.
Report cards, uh-huh.
Citizen of the month.
Citizen of the month, okay. Yeah.
Our family vacations and camping trips were definitely the holiest time that I remember in my memory.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. First day of school is still a big one at our house. You know, remember that feeling of, you know, the brand new crayons and the brand new pencils and all that. From the time our oldest started kindergarten, he asked for this because, you know, we had the supply list and all that. So we gotten all these school supplies. He asked that we gift wrap those and have those ready for the night before school started. So we've done that ever since. It's slightly shifted lately because they want just this kind of notebook, and, you know, and so it's not cool if they don't know exactly what it is. So then one of them volunteered to come with me and get just what so-and-so would really like, but the other two didn't know what it was. But it was really interesting because a year or two ago, I think it was about the time he was headed into fourth grade, it was real mixed feelings. And the kind of ritual that he had initially suggested really helped, you know, to kind of make that a little more special, as he really wasn't sure whether he wanted to go back that year or not. Thank you. When we start on a family vacation, we do a prayer of a blessing, and it's kind of different people's turns about please keep us, you know, happy and healthy on the trip.
Yeah.
And when Mitch and I travel, which we don't do a whopping amount, but we do occasionally, we ask the kids for a blessing. And so they will bless us, you know, please have a happy and safe trip and God be with you. And that started initially because you mentioned bedtimes. We do the nightly blessings. Anybody do that tradition of blessing your children at bedtime? As we tuck them in, whoever's tucking in that night, we'll make the sign of the cross on their forehead, and I say, God bless you and have a peaceful night. And what do you say?
Go to sleep or I'll wring your neck.
That's more normal.
Now that's religious.
My kids' bedtime was always the benediction.
Ah.
Or until they didn't want lullabies anymore, and now that's gone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, one of the ways we first heard about it was a family who had grown kids who had had it shared with them when their kids were small, that it was the father's kind of special privilege to bless their children. And they shared that when one of their sons came back from the army, he asked for his father's blessing. He said, I really miss that, Dad. So it has that kind of a power, I think. There's something, I think, really naturally holy about kind of tucking in at the end of the day, reflecting on how the day has been, and knowing my parents' love and God's love is all a part of that and one. And no matter how much we've been at odds all day, there really is this, you know, our middle son and I are so much alike. We're constantly at this with each other, you know, or somebody else will take a turn, but, you know, and so we often talk about, Pat, we really, you know, get into it with each other, don't we? But the love is always stronger, right, Pat? Yeah, Mom, the love is always, and we have to kind of remind ourselves of that occasionally, but it's true.
That reminds me,
yeah.
Also, often when you teach your children to pray, often the first thing you teach them is thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, thank you for the day, thank you for this. And I think that carries on as they get older. At the end of the day, you say thank you, and here they might have had a rotten day and ups and downs, but you get to the end and you still say, that's how you're taught, or you know, you still keep that thank you. And then I think that's maybe the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Knowing that through it all, God was with you, or you know, now it's bedtime. I guess it was good after all.
Yeah, yeah. For me, planting a garden is really a holy time, because it always feels miraculous to see this tiny seed, you know, go in there, and I figured that's probably the last I'm going to see it, even though I know that's not the case. We've tried to do a house blessing. Well, we did it when we moved in. We moved in a new house a year ago, and I want to try and remember that anniversary. And when we got a minivan, it was a bigger car, and for us was not just for our family, but also so we could, you know, haul their people and kids around, and have done a fair amount of that. And I warned the kids that we were going to have a blessing of our new car. Oh, Mom, it's just a car, you know, but to me it's more than that, you know. And I think especially in terms of our house, the dwelling in which we are really shapes how we live there, I think, in some pretty powerful ways. One of the fun stories that I like to tell.
Well, maybe I was going to just tell it.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll tell it. I think it's one of the most important principles for family prayer and ritual is being able to seize the moment, you know, spontaneous, recognize it and be able to do something about it before it goes away. And one of the best examples we have from our experience of that was, I'm sure I've missed a lot of these, you know, but one time when I actually did it right, when our kids were considerably younger, all three of them had, within the last few days, gotten new riding toys. There was a new tricycle and a couple new tricycles and a new, you know, the little one was on one of these little push things, you know. And it was just very obvious to me that this was a real source of joy for them, and I thought, this is where they're experiencing God, you know, now in their own experience. So we had them wheel them up to the front porch of the house, and we ran and got a candle, and we lit the candle, and there was no wind. It was great. And had each one hold the candle, and we just said a little informal, spontaneous blessing type of prayer about this new riding toy, and you know, one after the other. And they wheeled off, and we had surfaced for them the holy, in that experience. And I think it was just a real important moment for them at that point. And I'm always glad I did that. Maybe you have some experiences similar to that, where you were able to, for once you did it right. You know, parents have those moments.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know how this blessing, tricycles, I don't know how that is in other people's tradition. I don't know if we'd say it in a different way. Is anyone else?
Hmm. That sounds pretty Catholic, what we did.
Well, I don't know.
It's an attempt to overcome that dichotomy between the sacred and the secular, and to say it is in the ordinary that we encounter the holy.
I'm blessing the house. My sister did that with their new house, and at that time I thought, well, of course you would do that. That sounds like something. But then someone else told me about how there was a movement in churches to do that, and I thought, well, that's sort of like in Japan, where they have the Shinto priests come to chase away the spooks and the gods.
Yeah. Yeah, if the religious figure is the one doing that, but for us, when we did it, we gathered our friends together who meet regularly for some shared prayer time anyway, and went from room to room, but it was us blessing, recognizing the holiness of what's already there, not making it holy again, but recognizing the holiness that's there, and somehow saying that. And I want to pass around that reminds me a couple of resource kinds of books. And these are not exhaustive, I just couldn't bring very many with me. This one, unfortunately, is not in print right now, but it's a really good example of one that works for younger children. As a matter of fact, we said the prayer before going on vacation as we got here. The title, Prayer After 9 Rainy Days, you can imagine what the prayer of a parent of a small child after 9 rainy days is, but anyway. And there's a prayer on the death of a cat in here. No, she's from Minneapolis. Well, at least it was published in Minneapolis. There is a prayer about the death of a pet in here and the fight on the playground and stuff like that. It's pretty neat. But this one, Prayers for the Domestic Church, there is a house blessing toward the beginning that we did use, and it talks about how the bathroom is holy because here is a place where we really specially tend to our bodies and our bodies are holy and that sort of thing. But I don't think it's making it holy. I think really it is recognizing the holiness of what's there.
There isn't any sense. There's a whole different worldview involved. There's no sense of chasing the evil out.
Yeah.
That kind of thing at all. It's more lifting the shades from our own eyes to help ourselves recognize the holiness that is in fact already there and celebrating that.
Now, I think there's a fairly strong, yes, there is a fairly strong sacramental tradition in the Lutheran Church, and there certainly is in the Catholic tradition. And Dan and I were talking about this the other day. I think for us, and I can't speak for your tradition, when we've talked about sacraments with a capital S, we've said these times, these places, these people are holy people with a capital H, and that makes the rest of everything not as holy, okay, at least, if not secular. And what I'm seeing increasingly is that, for me, the image of a lens or a prism is an important one. That it's not to set these things as above or holy and the rest as secular, but it's rather to look through these events and to see in a new and deeper way the holiness of all it is. So if when I gather for Eucharist, when I gather for the Lord's Supper, that doesn't mean that just this bread and this wine is holy. It means that when we gather for macaroni and cheese or leftovers or whatever it is, that's also holy. When two or more are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of you. And I think there's something really naturally holy about a meal, because I think we bring more than physical hunger to the time of eating together. I mean, just think about the picnic we just had. You know, one of the things I hate most, I don't know about you, is to eat by myself. It kind of sticks in my throat or lower. And it's just not the same thing. But there's something about, I really want to be nourished at least as much in who I am as I do in terms of the physical calories and all that. So I think that there's that we really need to open our eyes again and to look again at what's all around us and really holy. And that's why I think celebrating the ordinary times is so important. I'd like to just share a couple of basic principles and then kind of open it for more questions and comments. It seems to me, in terms of all family prayer and ritual, that the first thing is to start simple. Simply. If you know, would feel like in our house it might work to have a nightly blessing, for example, or whatever it is, I think to start with one thing that feels like it really might be naming the holy a bit more in our midst makes sense, rather than, whoops, mom and dad, mom or dad, went to a workshop and came back and watch out, you know, here it goes. I mean, it's just phony, you know, it just doesn't work that way. It has to grow really organically. And also, it seems to me that we need to look at our own family's rhythm. What we haven't really said yet, that I think is really important, I was mentioning this before our session, when we talk about our particular family or web of basic relationships as holy, as church, that really has a uniqueness to it, okay? So what works for the Finleys is not going to work, I don't need an F there, is not going to work for the Joneses, is not going to work for the Millers, is not going to work for the so-and-so, and such and such. We each have our own spirituality, and so what's the rhythm? What are the times when we do gather together, and where is that? Is it better to talk about a time of really gathering with each other at bedtime? Is it better at dinner time? Is it better at Sunday dinner? I know a family that gets up about a half an hour early for the things they need to do in the morning and has a bit of Bible study and shared prayer time. That is great, but there is no way in our house that a half an hour in the morning is going to happen for something like that. There just ain't no way. But it's great, you know. I mean, more power to them. So I think we have to see what'll work at our house, you know. Then we need to share the planning, and this is crucial as our children grow. So it's not mom's thing, it's not dad's thing, it's not whoever's thing. But everybody has a part of the action. If we've got someone in our family who plays or is learning to play a musical instrument and would like to participate in that way, great, you know, or whatever it is. Somebody wants to make a sign, somebody wants to decorate the table, whatever it is, I think that's really important so that it really is all of ours. And along with that, I think, you know, our kids are rapidly approaching the not cool stage to do those sorts of things. What do we do with non-participants? It seems to me that we need to really allow them to be where they are, to have those concerns and those feelings, but I don't think it stops us cold, okay? This could be true in terms of an interfaith marriage. One spouse is really not comfortable with any kinds of prayer ritual kinds of experiences, though I think some of that can depend on how those are designed. We can talk more about that if you'd like. But, you know, maybe we've got a junior high or high schooler who just does not want to be part of things. And so I think we can say to that person, what do you think of this? I think we can say to that person, we'd really like you to be part of this. We understand that you're not feeling comfortable with that right now, but we're going to go ahead and do it anyway. And if you feel like you want to join us at any point, you're welcome. Because I think there's a part of a lot of kids at that age that is aching to be part of that, but really can't do it right now. There's just something that is trying to pull away at the same time. So I think we need to be willing to let them be who and where they are at that point. And then I think really crucial is the process of reevaluating. We tried it this way this week or this time. How did that go? The Prayers for the Domestic Church, the fatter book that I'm sending around, has very long prayers. It works great in an adult context. There are a number of prayers in there that I use myself personally. But for the most part, if we use those at home, we lose the kids. And there are a couple of other books of family prayer that are nice, but they're too churchy. You know, the leader says something and everybody else responds something else. You know, not at our house. Maybe it's somebody else's house. But I think we really have to watch. Have we lost them? You know, was it too long? Was it too involved? Then we really need to reevaluate and say, well, we're going to do it another way next time. How about comments or questions about what I said there or anything that I said at we've said at this point.
Question number four.
Okay.
Patients with non-participants, like if you use Holden Village, the one thing that's required is Vespers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's that difficult to say our rule is everybody participates in the devotion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I don't have children that are that age that are that rebellious.
Uh-huh.
So I think a couple rules, and there's no question about, you know, do you want to do it, but, you know, they don't have a choice. It's just everybody does
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it might be a little easier than to, but that's just my opinion.
Uh-huh. Or, sure. What do you think?
I think at Holden it would be permitted to be in the room apart from the people who are worshiping and keep your hands in your lap and not be doing what's going on in the room. Your body is requested to be there. And that's really different than what we would be insisting that our children do if we insist that they participate. First of all, they're so intimately, our rooms are smaller than that room.
Yeah.
But a half hour is a half hour, and to try to get a Vesper that goes for a 5-year-old and for a 70-year-old, it's difficult. But
yeah, it's tricky to come up with prayer forms that work for us well in a family with real diversity of ages. But I think there really are degrees of participation. I think I would tend to agree. Did somebody have a hand up over here? Anybody else on that one? I think that is one of those places where there's going to be diversity among various families.
Some of the words that I have related to going to college, and I hadn't thought about not going to college. And it's like more like, you know, the question is do you want to go to church today? It's called, you don't even ask the question. You know, or it might be like in case, do you want, it's called time for church. You know? Trying to get ready for church. Now, not opening the door for another choice
right.
very easily.
Right.
Like folks at Indians College is more like, well, what college did you want to go to?
Sure. And again, just to be clear here, I am not talking about, at least in our household to this point, probably not for a good long time, do you want to go to church or not? We're talking about times of sharing the holiness that is within our home, which is a really different situation, which is a smaller group, smaller space, and if you're there in body but not in spirit, it's really going to be noticed in a different sort of a way. And you know, again, we haven't hit a whole lot of that personally at this point, but other parents have reported to me, we can try a candle at the table, which is one of the things I was going to bring up, we didn't, which we've had since... since Mitch and I were engaged, and we turn off the light over the table and just have a candlelight while we join hands and pray before our meal. That one is, it's not a choice except, you know, on a regular basis, it's, ooh, I don't want to hold his hand or, you know, your hand's cold or wet or whatever it is, you know. Well, I mean, you're not going to get up from the table, and it's not an option whether you pray at the table. But there are some times if we wanted to, say, have... some kind of a ritualizing of forgiveness and reconciliation in the home that somebody might feel not cool about.
Could you just explain what you actually mean by holiness? Because it sounds to me like you're talking as much about just a thankfulness and an appreciation
mm-hmm.
At what you have at home. So is that, do you
right.
really mean a holiness, a spiritual?
I mean a holiness. It seems to me that when we talk about the incarnation, to get theological for a minute, all of creation has been made holy in Christ. And I think that we don't think about that enough. The implications are tremendous. They're all about the theme that we're talking about this summer, that if all that we have is holy, then, you know, and God doesn't make junk and so on, then it has real implications as to how we live and how we treat things. And I think that as Christians, we've somehow missed the boat in terms of saying, well, these things are holy, but these are, you know. And that's not the case, and therefore my attitude toward this holiness, you know, my kitchen is holy, my bedroom is holy, everything about my life is holy. If I'm on holy ground, oh, that was one thing I wanted to do, darn it, I forgot. if I'm on holy ground, I don't know if anybody's familiar with John Michael Talbot's song, this is holy ground, we're standing in holy ground, it's a lovely song. Not enough time here. Then my attitude is thankfulness and gratitude, but it is not just in what God has made, yes it's that, but also God is here with me, and this is a holy place. And I don't have to go to church to have a holy place. I don't think that's a Catholic idea versus Lutheran. I'm pretty sure not. This is a holy place, and I don't think we've really, it's gotten through to us quite the way it needs to.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? I really felt that today down in the crafts room. That's a holy place. You know, we're making, we're doing what the Creator has done with us and for us and what we're about to. We need to end here. Thank you.